He sat down on one of the hard cushions which we have to bet use instead of chairs, for we sit upon the floor cross-legged, so seated. He motioned for me to follow his example, which I did with alacrity because the sight of food was always one to make me hurry. We ate in comparative silence. In Tibet, particularly among monks, it was not considered seemly to speak or to make a noise while food was before us. Monks alone ate in silence, but if they were in a congregation of any great number, a reader would read aloud from the sacred books. This reader would be in a high place where, in addition to seeing his book, he could look out across the gathering monks, and see immediately those who were so engrossed with their food that they had no time for his words. When there was a congregation of monks eating, then proctors also would be present to see that there was no talking except for the monk reader. But we were alone, we passed a few desultory remarks to each other, knowing that many of the old customs, such as remaining silent at meals, were good for discipline when one was in a throng, but were not necessary for just a pair such as we. So, in my conceit, I classed myself as an associate of one of the truly great men of my country. "Well, Lobsang," said my guide when we had finished our meal, "tell me what it is that bothers you so?"
"Honorable Lama,"
I said in some excitement, "a trader passing through here, and with whom I was discussing matters of some moment at the western gate, gave me some remarkable information about the people of the West. He told me that they thought our religious paintings obscene. He told me some incredible things about their sex habits, and I am still not at all sure that he was not taking me for a fool." My guide looked at me and thought for a moment or two, then he said, "To go into this matter, Lobsang, would take more than one session. We have to go to our service and the time is near for that. Let us just discuss one aspect of this first, shall we?" I nodded, very eagerly, because I really was most puzzled about all this. My guide then said, "All this springs from religion. The religion of the West is different from the religion of the East. We should look into this and see what bearing it has on the subject." He arranged his robes about him more comfortably, and rang for the attendant to clear the things from the table. When that had been done, he turned to me and started a discussion which I found to be of enthralling interest. "Lobsang," he said, "we must draw a parallel between one of the religions of the West and our own Buddhist religion. You will realize from your lessons that the teachings of our Lord Gautama have been altered somewhat in the course of time. Throughout the years and the centuries which have elapsed since the passing from this earth of the Gautama and his elevation to Buddhahood, the teachings which he personally taught have changed. Some of us think they have changed for the worse. Others think that the teachings have been brought into line with modern thought." He looked at me to see if I was following him with sufficient attention, to see if I understood what he was talking about. I understood and I followed him perfectly. He nodded to me briefly and then continued, "We had our great being whom we call Gautama, whom some call the Buddha. The Christians also had their great being. Their great being propounded certain teachings. Legend and, in fact, actual records testify to the fact that their great being who, according to their own scriptures, wandered abroad in the wilderness, actually visited India and Tibet in search of information, in search of knowledge, about a religion which would be suitable for Western mentalities and spiritualities. This great being came to Lhasa and actually visited our cathedral, the Jokhang. The great being then returned to the West and formulated a religion which was in every way admirable and suitable for the Western people. With the passing of that great being from this earth, as our own Gautama passed, certain dissensions arose in the Christian Church. Some 60 years after that passing, a convention, or meeting, was held at a place called Constantinople. Certain changes were made in Christian dogma, certain changes were made in Christian belief. Probably some of the priests of the day felt that they had to put in a few torments in order to keep some of the more refractory of their congregation in good order." Again he looked at me to see if I was following him. Again I indicated that I was not merely following him, but that I was vastly interested. The men who attended that convention at Constantinople in the year 60 were men who were not sympathetic toward women, just as some of our monks feel faint at the mere thought of a woman.
The majority of them regarded sex as something unclean, something which should only be resorted to in the case of absolute necessity in order to increase the race. These were men who had no great sexual urges themselves. No doubt they had other urges, perhaps some of those urges were spiritual, I do not know. I only know that in the year 60 they decided that sex was unclean, sex was the work of the devil. They decided that children were brought into the world unclean and were not fit to go to a reward until in some way they had been cleansed first. He paused a moment and then smiled as he said, I do not know what is supposed to happen to all the millions of babies born before this meeting at Constantinople. You will understand, Lobsang, that I am giving you information about Christianity as I understand it. Possibly when you go to live among these people you will have some different impression or different information which may in some way modify my own opinions and teachings. As he finished his statement the conches sounded, and the temple trumpets blared. About us there was the ordered bustle of disciplined men getting ready for the service. We too stood up and brushed off our robes before making our way down to the temple for the service. Before leaving me at the entrance, my guide said, come to my room after, Lobsang, and we will continue our discussion. So I entered into the temple and I took my place among my fellows, and I said my prayers and I thanked my own particular God that I was a Tibetan the same as my guide. The Lama Minya dawned up. It was beautiful in the old temple, the air of worship, the gently drifting clouds of incense which kept us in touch with people on other planes of existence. Incense is not just a pleasant smell, not something which disinfects a temple, it is a living force, a force which is so arranged that by picking a particular type of incense we can actually control the rate of vibration. Tonight, in the temple, the incense was floating and giving a mellow, old-world atmosphere to the place. I looked out from my place among the boys of my group, looked out into the dim mists of the temple building. There was the deep chanting of the old lamas accompanied by, at times, the silver bells. Tonight we had a Japanese monk with us. He had come all the way across our land after having stopped in India for some time. He was a great man in his own country, and he had brought with him his wooden drums, drums which play such a great part in the religion of the Japanese monks. I marveled at the versatility of the Japanese monk, at the remarkable music he produced from his drums. It seemed truly amazing to me that hitting a sort of wooden box could sound so very musical. He had the wooden drum and he had sort of clappers, each with little bells attached, and also our own lamas accompanied him with silver bells, with the great temple conch booming out in appropriate time. It seemed to me that the whole temple vibrated. The walls themselves seemed to dance and shimmer, and the mists away in the distance of the far recesses seemed to form into faces, the faces of long-dead lamas. But for once all too soon, the service had ended, and I hurried off as arranged to my guide. The Lama Minya dawned up. You have not wasted much time, Lobsang, said my guide cheerfully. I thought perhaps you would be stopping to have one of those innumerable snacks. No, Honorable Lama, I said, I am anxious to get some enlightenment, for I confess the subject of sex in the Western world is one which has caused me a lot of astonishment after having heard so much about it from traders and others. He laughed at me and said, sex causes a lot of interest everywhere. It is sex, after all, which keeps people on this earth. We will discuss it as you require it so. Honorable Lama, I said, you said previously that sex was the second greatest force in the world. What did you mean by that? If sex is so necessary in order to keep the world populated, why is it not the most important force? The greatest force in the world, Lobsang, said my guide, is not sex. The greatest force of all is imagination, for without imagination there would be no sexual impulse. If a male had no imagination, then the male could not be interested in the female. Without imagination there would be no writers, no artists, there would be nothing whatever that was constructive or good. But, Honorable Lama, I said, are you saying that imagination is necessary for sex? And if you are, how does imagination apply to animals? Imagination is possessed by animals, Lobsang, just as it is possessed by humans. Many people think that animals are mindless creatures, without any form of intelligence, without any form of reason, yet I, who have lived a surprisingly long number of years, tell you differently. My guide looked at me, and then shaking a finger at me he said, "You profess to be fond of the temple cats, are you going to tell me that they have no imagination? You always speak to the temple cats, you stop to caress them. After you have been affectionate with them once they will wait for you a second time, and a third time, and so on." If this were mere insensitive reactions, if these were just brain patterns, then the cat would not wait for you on a second or third occasion, but would wait until the habit had been formed. No, Lobsang, any animal has imagination. An animal imagines the pleasures in being with its mate, and then the inevitable occurs. When I came to think about it, to dwell upon the subject, it was perfectly clear to me that my guide was absolutely right. I had seen little birds, little hens, fluttering their wings in much the same way as young women flutter their eyelids. I had watched little birds and seen very real anxiety as they waited for their mates to return from the unceasing forage for food. I had seen the joy with which a loving little bird had greeted her mate upon his return. It was obvious to me, now that I thought about it, that animals really had imagination, and so I could see the sense of my guide's remarks that imagination was the greatest force on earth. One of the traders told me that the more occult a person was the more he was opposed to sex. "Honorable Lama," I said. "Is this true, or am I being teased? I have heard so many very strange things that I really do not know how I stand in the matter." The Lama Minyadon Up nodded sadly, as he replied, "It is perfectly true, Lobsang, that many people who are intensely interested in occult matters are intensely antipathetic to sex, and for a special reason. You have been told before that the greatest occultists are not normal, that is, they have something wrong with them physically. A person may have a grave disease, such as TB, or cancer, or anything of that nature. A person may have some nerve complaint, whatever it is an illness and that illness increases metaphysical perceptions." He frowned slightly as he continued, "Many people find that the sexual impulse is a great drive. Some people for one reason or another use methods of sublimating that sexual drive, and they may turn to things spiritual. Once a man or a woman has turned away from a thing they become a deadly enemy to that thing. There is no greater reformer, nor greater campaigner, against the evils of drink than the reformed drunkard. In the same way, a man or a woman who has renounced sex, possibly because they could not satisfy nor be satisfied, will turn to occult matters, and all the drive which formerly went, successfully or unsuccessfully, into sexual adventures is now devoted to occult adventures. But unfortunately these people so often tend to be unbalanced about it, they tend to bleat that only in renouncing sex is it possible to progress. Nothing could be more fantastic, nothing could be more distorted. Some of the greatest people are able to enjoy a normal life and also to progress vastly in metaphysics." Just at that moment the great medical Lama Chinro Bonobo came in, we greeted him and he sat down with us. "I am just telling Lobsang some matters about sex and occultism," said my guide. "Ah yes," said the Lama Chinro Bonobo, "it is time he was given some information on this, I have thought so for a long time." My guide continued, "It is clear that those who use sex normally, as it is meant to be used, increase their own spiritual force. Sex is not a matter to be abused, but on the other hand nor is it a matter to be repudiated. By bringing vibrations to a person that person can increase spiritually. I want to point out to you, however," he said looking sternly at me, "that the sexual act should only be indulged in by those who are in love, by those who are bound together by spiritual affinity. That which is illicit, unlawful, is mere prostitution of the body and can harm one as much as the other can help one. In the same way a man or a woman should have only one partner, eschewing all temptations which would lead one from the path of truth and righteousness." The Lama Chinro Bonobo said, "But there is another matter upon which you should dwell, respected colleague, and it is this, the matter referring to birth control. I will leave you to deal with it." He rose to his feet, bowed gravely to us and left the room. My guide waited for a moment, and then said, Are you tired of this yet, Lobsang?
No, sir. I replied, I am anxious to learn all I can, for all this is strange to me.
Then you should know that in the early days of life upon earth, peoples were divided into families. Throughout areas of the world there were small families which, with the passage of time, became big families. As seems to be inevitable among humans, quarrels and dissensions occurred. Family fought against family. The victors killed the men they had vanquished and took their women into their own family. Soon it became clear that the bigger the family, which was now referred to as a tribe, the more powerful and the more secure it was from the aggressive acts of others. He looked at me a bit ruefully, and then continued, the tribes were increasing in size as the years and centuries went by. Some men set up as priests, but priests with a bit of political power, with an eye to the future. The priests decided that they had to have a sacred edict, what they could call a command from God, which would help the tribe as a whole. They taught that one had to be fruitful and multiply. In those days it was a very real necessity, because unless people multiplied their tribe became weak and perhaps completely wiped out. So, the priests who commanded that the people be fruitful and multiply were even safeguarding the future of their own tribe. With the passage of centuries and centuries, however, it is quite clear that the population of the world is increasing at such a pace that the world is becoming overpopulated. There are more people than food resources justify. Something will have to be done about it. I could follow all this, it made sense to me, and I was glad to see that my friends of the Pargokling, the traders who had traveled so far and for so long, had told me the truth. My guide continued, some religions even now think that it is wrong indeed to place any limitation upon the number of children who are born, but if one looks at world history one sees that most of the wars are caused by lack of living space on the part of the aggressor. A country has a rapidly expanding population, and it knows that if it goes on expanding at this rate there will not be enough food, not be enough opportunity, for those of its own peoples. Thus they make war, saying they have to have living space. Then, Honorable Lama, I said, how would you deal with the problem?
Lobsang.
He replied, the matter is easy if men and women of goodwill get together to discuss the thing. The old forms of religions, the old religious teachings were in every way suitable when the world was young, when people were few, but now it is inevitable, and it will be in time, that fresh approaches be made. You ask what I would do about it? Well, I would do this, I would make birth control legal. I would teach all peoples about birth control, how it could be accomplished, what it was, and all that could be discovered about it. I would see that those people who wanted children could have perhaps one or two, while those who did not want children had the knowledge whereby children would not be born. According to our religion, Lobsang, there would be no offense in doing this. I have studied the old books dating back long, long ages before life appeared on western parts of this globe, for, as you know, life first appeared in China and in the areas around Tibet, and spread to India before going westwards. However, we are not dealing with that. I decided then and there that as soon as I could I would get my guide to talk more about the origin of life upon this earth, but I recollected that now I was studying all I could on the matter of sex. My guide was watching me, and as he saw that I was again paying attention he continued, as I was saying, the majority of wars are caused by overpopulation. It is a fact that there will be wars, there will always be wars, so long as there are vast and increasing populations. And it is necessary that there should be, for otherwise the world would be absolutely overrun with people in the same way that a dead rat is soon completely overrun by swarms of ants. When you move away from Tibet, where we have a very small population, and you go to some of the great cities of the world, you will be amazed and appalled at the vast numbers, at the vast throngs of people. You will see that my words are correct. Wars are utterly necessary to keep down the population. People have to come to Earth in order to learn things, and unless there were wars and diseases, then there would be no way whatever of keeping the population in control and keeping them fed. They would be like a swarm of locusts eating everything in sight, contaminating everything, and in the end they would finish themselves up completely. Honorable Lama. I said,
Some of the traders who have talked about this birth control thing say that so many people think that it is evil. Now why should they think that? My guide thought for a moment, probably wondering how much he should tell me, for I was as yet still young, and then he said, "Birth control to some appears to be murder of a person unborn, but in our faith, Lobsang, the spirit has not entered the unborn baby. In our faith no murder can possibly have occurred, and anyhow it is, of course, manifestly absurd to say that there is any murder in taking precautions to prevent conception. It is just as well to say that we murder a whole lot of plants if we prevent their seeds from germinating. Humans too often imagine that they are the most wonderful thing that ever happened in this great universe. Actually, of course, humans are just one form of life, and not the highest form of life at that. However, there is no time to go into such matters as that for the present." I thought of another thing which I had heard, and it seemed to be such a shocking, such a terrible thing, that I could hardly bring myself to speak of it. However, I did. "Honorable Lama, I have heard that some animals, cows for instance, are made pregnant by unnatural means. Is that correct?" My guide looked quite shocked for a moment, and then he said, "Yes, Lobsang, that is absolutely correct. There are certain peoples in the Western world who try to raise cattle by what they call artificial insemination. That is, the cows are inseminated by a man with a great big syringe instead of having a bull do the necessary work. These people do not seem to realize that in making a baby, whether it be a baby human, a baby bear, or a baby cow, there is more than just a mechanical mating. If one is going to have good stock, then there must be love or a form of affection in the mating process. If humans were artificially inseminated, then it could be that, being born without love, they would be subhumans. I repeat to you, Lobsang, that for the better type of human or beast it is necessary that the parents shall be fond of each other, that they shall both be raised in spiritual as well as physical vibration. Artificial insemination, carried out in cold, loveless conditions, results in very poor stock indeed. I believe that artificial insemination is one of the major crimes upon this earth." I sat there, with the evening shadows stealing across the room, bathing the Lama Minyadon up in the growing dusk, and as the dusk increased I saw his aura flaring with the great gold of spirituality. To me, clairvoyantly, the light was bright indeed and interpenetrated the dusk itself. My clairvoyant perceptions told me, as if I did not know before, that there I was in the presence of one of the greatest men of Tibet. I felt warm inside me, I felt my whole being throb with love for this, my guide and tutor. Beneath us the temple conches blared again. But this time they were not calling us, but calling others. Together we walked to the window and looked out. My guide put his hand on my shoulder as we looked out at the valley below us, the valley now partially enveloped in the purple darkness. "Let your conscience be your guide, Lobsang," said my guide. "You will always know if a thing is right or if a thing is wrong. You are going far, farther than you can imagine, and you will have many temptations placed before you. Let your conscience be your guide. We in Tibet are a peaceful people. We are people of a small population. We are people who live in peace, who believe in holiness, who believe in the sanctity of the spirit. Wherever you go, whatever you endure, let your conscience be your guide. We are trying to help you with your conscience. We are trying to give you extreme telepathic power and clairvoyance so that always in the future, for so long as you live, you can get in touch telepathically with great lamas here in the high Himalayas, great lamas who, later, will devote the whole of their time to waiting for your messages." "Waiting for my messages?" I am afraid my jaw dropped with amazement. "My messages? What was there so special about me? Why should great lamas be waiting for my messages all the time?" My guide laughed and slapped my shoulder. "The reason for your existence, Lobsang, is that you have a very, very special task to do. In spite of all the hardships, in spite of all the suffering, you will succeed in your task. But it is manifestly unfair that you should be left on your own in an alien world, a world that will mock you and call you a liar, fraud and fake. Never despair, never give up, for right will prevail. You, Lobsang, will prevail." The evening shadows turned into the darkness of night, Below us the lights of the city were at a twinkle. Above us a new moon was peeping down at us over the edge of the mountains. The planets, vast millions of them, twinkled in the purple heavens. I looked up, thought of all the forecasts about me, all the prophecies about me, and I thought also of the trust and the confidence shown by my friend, my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup. And I was content. Chapter 10. The teacher was in a bad mood. Perhaps his tea had been too cold, perhaps his sampa had not been roasted or mixed exactly to his liking. The teacher was in a bad mood. We boys sat in the classroom just about shivering with fright. Already he had pounced unexpectedly upon boys to my right and boys to my left. My memory was good, I knew the lessons perfectly, I could repeat chapter and verse from any part of the 108 volumes of the Kanjaya. Thwack! Thwack! I jumped about a foot in the air with surprise, and about three boys to the left and three boys to the right also jumped a foot in the air with surprise. For a moment we hardly knew which of us was getting the hiding, then, as the teacher laid it on a bit harder, I knew that I was the unlucky one. He continued his beating, muttering all the time, "Lama's favorite. Pampered idiot. I'll teach you to learn something." The dust rose from my robe in a choking cloud and started me sneezing. For some reason that enraged the teacher even more, and he really worked up into knocking more dust out of me. Fortunately, unknown to him, I had anticipated his bad mood and had put on more clothes than usual, so, although he would not have been pleased to know it, his blows did not disturb me unduly. In any case, I was hardened. This teacher was tyrannical. He was a perfectionist without being perfect himself. Not only did we have to be word perfect in our lesson work, but if the pronunciation, the inflection, was not exactly to his desire, he would take out his cane, whip round to the back, and then whip us on our backs. Now he was getting some exercise, and I was nearly suffocating with the dust. Small boys in Tibet, like small boys everywhere, roll in the dust when they fight or when they play, and small boys completely cut off from all feminine influence do not always make sure that the dust is out of their clothing. Mine was full of dust and this really was as good as a spring clean. The teacher went on thwacking away, "I'll teach you to mispronounce a word. Showing disrespect to the sacred knowledge. Pampered idiot, always missing classes and then coming back and knowing more than the ones that I've taught, useless brat, I'll teach you, you'll learn from me one way or another." In Tibet we sit on the floor cross-legged, most times we sit on cushions which are about 4 inches thick, and in front of us we have tables which may be from 12 to 18 inches from the ground, depending on the size of the student. This teacher suddenly put his hand forcibly on the back of my head and pushed my head down onto my table where I had a slate and a few books. Having me in a suitable position, he took a deep breath and really got busy. I wriggled just from habit, not because I was being hurt, because in spite of his most earnest endeavors we boys were toughened, we were almost literally tanned into leather, and things like this were just an everyday occurrence. Some boy made a soft chuckle 6 or 7 boys away to the right, the teacher dropped me as if I had suddenly glowed red hot and leapt like a tiger onto the other boy. I was careful to betray no indication of my own amusement when I saw a cloud of dust arising a few boys down the line. There were various exclamations of pain, fright, and horror from my right, because the teacher was hitting out indiscriminately, not being at all sure which boy it was. At last, out of breath, and no doubt feeling a lot better, the teacher stopped his exertions. "Ah!" he gasped. "That will teach you little horrors to pay attention to what I am saying. Now, Lobsang Rampa, start again and make sure that you get the pronunciation perfect." I commenced all over again, and when I thought about a thing I really could do it well enough. This time I thought, and then I thought again, so there were no more hard feelings from the teacher and harder thwacks on me. For the whole of that session, 5 hours in all, the teacher paraded backwards and forwards, keeping a very sharp eye indeed upon all of us, and no provocation at all was needed for him to lash out and catch some unlucky boy just when he thought he was unobserved. In Tibet we have our day starting at midnight. It starts then with a service, and of course there are regular services at regular intervals. Then we have to do menial work in order that we may be kept humble, in order that we shall not look down on the domestic staff. We also have a period of rest, and after that we go to our classes. These classes last 5 hours non-stop, and during that whole time the teachers were indeed making us learn thoroughly.